Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted because with us today are Lou Grummet and John Carr, authors of the new book, The Curious Case of Kiryas Joel, The Rise of a Village Theocracy and the Battle to Defend the Separation of Church and State. It's published by the Chicago Review Press. This is a story of religion, politics, culture, government, constitutional law, all centered on a small community of Satmar Hasidim that is so far outside the American mainstream that it cannot and will not assimilate. But it was oddly blind to the fact that by inviting, actually insisting upon, government accommodation, it was undermining the very instrument that protects its tradition and mores from government interference, the Establishment Clause and the First Amendment. It spotlights the timeless freedom from religion debate that engaged Madison and Jefferson more than 200 years ago. The authors of this book, The Curious Case of Kiryas Joel, do not have in any way dispute the fact that the handicapped children are entitled to special education services, just like any other child, or that the unique cultural aspects of the community require a unique government response. But they argue forcefully that the solution crafted by Mario Cuomo, that's right, Mario Cuomo, and the New York State Legislature was an illegitimate response to a legitimate problem, and that pose a provocative query. If the Satmar could declare themselves a public school district, why couldn't a group of Nazis or Islamic extremists do exactly the same thing? Buy up a bunch of farmland, subdivide it to their members, and form an exclusive school, and then force the public to pay for it with no voice in how it is being run. Our guests today are Lou Grummet, who was the plaintiff in the Board of Education of the Village of Kiryas Joel versus Grummet, the case that challenged the establishment of a special school district for a religious sect and led to a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision. At the time, Grummet was the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association, where I knew him for a long, long time. He's a former assistant commissioner for the education of children with handicapped conditions for the New York State Education Department. Prior to that, he served as special assistant to the then New York Secretary of State, Mario Cuomo. And he served as his representative in matters dealing with disabled individuals. He was also the executive director of the New York State Society of Certified Public Accountants, where he helped the state redesign and upgrade its accountability and ethics standards for the profession. He's written extensively on issues of education and governmental ethics and had an article published on the Kiryas Joel case in May 2011 issue of the New York State Bar Journal. His associate in this formidable enterprise is John Carr, who has been a professional writer for 3 decades, specializing in legal reportage. His reporting has garnered more than 20 awards, and I could go on and read them all to you, but I'm not going to. Let me welcome both of you for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay, so it's some story, and I want to warn those people who are out there listening who have high blood pressure to take an extra pill before you hear this, because this is not a pretty story. It really isn't. Lou Grummet, I need you to sort of just give us a précis of what this was all about. John, feel free to jump in at any moment. Lou.
Back in 1970s, the Grand Rebbe of the Satmar Hasidim, who had come over here from Europe, you know, during the Holocaust.
Is that Mr. Teitelbaum?
Yes.
Rabbi Teitelbaum.
Joel, that's the village is named after him, Joel Teitelbaum.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Kiryas Joel, Village of Joel. And Joel had Teitelbaum had brought his people to Brooklyn. They had established a huge community in Brooklyn.
An influential community that could really get politicians to get on their knees to him, right?
Well, the Satmar are a rather unique group, as we can discuss as we go along, who combine an absolute refusal to deal with our governmental structures and laws with probably the most comprehensive and energetic view of using our governmental system and laws that I've ever seen. They're good citizens. They vote. 94% of them vote in any election, and they vote the way the Grand Rebbe tells them.
Keep coming. So
that makes them very influential. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So Teitelbaum believes that he wants to recreate a community the way it existed in Eastern Europe before the Holocaust. So he wants a totally isolated community of people who are not part of the outside group.
They don't watch television. They don't want their kids to watch television, all the rest of that.
No
stuff.
Subways.
They don't want their people, their culture adulterated by popular American culture. And,
right.
and they form their own community to continue their ancient traditions.
So he believes that in downtown Brooklyn is not an easy place to avoid American culture. And so they buy some land in Orange County, land which had originally been set aside for development when Stewart became the fourth jetport, and therefore was relatively cheap because there was no fourth jetport. And they had other people from Canada go in and buy the land for them. They flipped the land, and now they owned this land. And they start building on it. Now, if you know much about Orange County, and I know you do, Orange County is where Velveeta was started. Orange County was onion country. Newburgh was shipbuilding country. But basically, it wasn't very well populated. It was farming country. And it probably wasn't the place where you would recreate a shtetl. And what they did is they wanted to build 2, 3, 4-story buildings, which happened to violate all of the zoning and building codes of the town of Monroe, named after President James Monroe. And so they go in and they form this, and the town of Monroe, as you might imagine, said, no, no, you can't build those things here. And we had very angry hearings, and we had litigation being filed, and then some very clever lawyer discovered that there is an anomaly in the New York State local government laws. In the village law, you do not need the state to create your unit of government. You can't create a town or a city or a school district without the state legislature, but you can create a village. All you need to do is have 600 or more people sign a petition and get that petition through, have your vote win, and you have yourself a village. So in 1977, they created the Village of Curious Joel, which single-handedly took care of the zoning problems and the building code problems. They adopted their own codes. They lived by them. But they had a problem in the village, and that was that they were reproducing very rapidly. They have, John, what's the figure of kids?
Right now, nearly a quarter of the population there is under the age of 5, more than 60% under the age of 18. And the average household has something like 6 people in it, you know, which is 2 or 3 times the average in Orange County.
So you're talking about very large families and a very small community. So you're talking about intermarriages. And you're talking about an unfortunately high percentage of disabled youngsters.
When you say intermarriages, do you mean intramarriages?
Yes.
People within the community
thank you.
You're marrying.
You're correct.
Yeah, right.
You're correct, because it's an isolated community.
Inevitably, somewhere in the line, there's going to be some shared genes or something, probably.
And they know
so,
about
I'm
it.
Sorry, John, I missed that somewhat.
Some shared genes, some shared DNA.
Yeah, which of course leads to problems, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a yes. regressive gene problem, and they're aware of it. Now, most of the kids, actually all of the kids, all the non-disabled kids in Curious Joel, didn't go to the Monroe Woodbury schools, which I'll get to in a minute. They went to yeshivas, to private yeshivas, the United Talmudic Academy, an extraordinarily politically powerful group today. And they educated them, but they couldn't afford to educate this high percentage of disabled youngsters. And so first of all, they have...
Well, let me see if I get this straight, because I'm a little slow here. Because of the shared gene pool, there's a high percentage, you think, of kids who have problems.
There's clearly a high percentage of severely disabled youngsters.
Yeah. Okay.
Who are very expensive to educate.
Yes, I get it.
Now, they're sitting in the middle, as I said I would get to, the Monroe Woodbury School District. Monroe Woodbury was one of New York's better school districts. I assume it still is. It was when I was around.
And you were the head of the school board association.
That's right.
Did you live down there too?
No. I lived in scenic Albany.
Okay.
Listening to your radio stations all the time and arguing with you occasionally. And Monroe Woodbury had a wonderful special ed program. And Monroe Woodbury would send teachers into the private schools, you know, to help them until the Supreme Court of the United States in the Aguilar decision said they couldn't do that, that they had to be on a neutral site. And now started a real war. In the midst of another war, just to make the point as to how isolated they are, they want boys and girls to be totally separately educated and kept separate. And they accepted public transportation, school buses, because they accepted all sorts of public money.
And that's an entitlement, right? That
they have every right to it.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
They didn't have a right to say that only women could drive girls and only men could drive boys.
Uh-huh.
Because there were union rules that said otherwise, that seniority was the motivating factor. And so we had litigation, which went all the way up to New York State court system, which said the union seniority rules were fine. So that didn't work. So now they decided that what they would try to do was to send their kids to the Monroe Woodbury schools, and Monroe Woodbury would set up special culturally sensitive, you know, groupings where, because most of these kids spoke Yiddish, not English. And that sounded like it would make sense. And then you have human beings getting involved. And some of the Monroe Woodbury teachers did some pretty stupid things. For example, one of the developmentally disabled youngsters was given the assignment to play Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in the Christmas pageant. Probably...
Not sensitive.
And other kids were taken on a field trip to McDonald's, which does not have an extensive kosher menu.
Right.
So they get to the situation where there's a war going on now between Monroe Woodbury and these very politically able individuals.
The Satmar.
And particularly Mayor Weeder, who is one of the smartest and craftiest political people I've ever met, and who tries very hard to keep the community living the way the Grand Rebbe wanted it to live in an isolated capacity.
So he's the mayor of the village that you spoke of.
And the president of the school board, as they created it.
Well.
And the head
And Rabbi Teitelbaum, he's still alive?
No.
He died.
No, the rabbi's wife became very important, and the new Grand Rebbe, who was the rabbi's nephew, who didn't get along with Rebbetzin.
Really? Rebbetzin, for those of you who don't know, is the wife of the rabbi.
And that war is part of the story as well, but I
want to hear about it. We got an hour.
We'll get there. But let's stay with the basic story. So the basic story was that there's a war going on between these, and there's another court case. And
war going on between who?
Between the village leaders and the Monroe Woodbury School Board.
Correct. Okay.
And there's more litigation filed, which gets to the Court of Appeals, and the late Judge Kaye wrote a brilliant opinion, probably the best opinion in the case, who I think both John and I think was a great judge and a great friend.
Me too.
Absolutely.
I did too.
Wrote the best opinion in 10 years of litigation, in which she basically said, this is a problem that should be solved back there. You don't need legislation, and you don't need to do all these crazy things. Just stop being stupid. Serve the kids. And it was a wonderful opinion that no one paid any attention to. So then you have, as we move along, a very important meeting in the house of the president of the Monroe Woodbury School Board. And then everybody's there. Monroe Woodbury leaders are there. The Curious Joel leaders are there. Congressman Ben Gilman was there, who at the time was the head of the House Foreign Relations Committee and had some clout and was a rabbi to the community, so to speak. And another rabbi to the community was the assemblyman, a man named George Pataki.
Interesting. Now, when you use the word rabbi, it has quotes around it, and it means what it means. In the police department, this is somebody who has influence and who is taking care of you.
That's what I mean. And George Pataki, who had been mayor of Peekskill, and by the way, Alan, this is interesting. In 10 years of litigation, I didn't know this story. George Pataki told me the story when I interviewed him for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I then cross-checked it, and he was right. Pataki had been the mayor of Peekskill, and during his mayoralty of Peekskill, he had tried to grab the school district legislatively and failed.
Tried to grab it for Peekskill?
For Peekskill.
Right.
There were several school districts within Peekskill, and he wanted one coterminous, city of Peekskill and school district. He failed. But he remembered the battle. And he was a big fan of the small city school districts, which I know you're aware of, and they had tried to get more independence than you usually have for a school district. And they failed. But George remembered that. So George said, if you guys can't get along, why don't we just put in a piece of legislation and create your own school district for the village? Now, there are no villages with school districts. You need to know that. And everyone said, that's okay. Although some of the Hussies, some of the Satmar, did not want to own the government. They thought that was too close for comfort. And they were right, by the way. But nevertheless, as time moved on, and you'll see my personal views, George Pataki did not think he was doing anything about church state. He was trying to solve a constituency problem. He was an ambitious young assemblyman.
But he also knew that this group had a lot of political clout.
He sure did. Mm-hmm. And he wanted that clout, as it has been, dedicated to his career the rest of his life, and he got it. As late as his rather strange presidential campaign, there were Satmar out working the lines for George Pataki.
Interesting.
This year.
That time it didn't seem to help. In other words, when Pataki ran for president, he sort of made a fool of himself.
He did, but the Satmar helped.
But going back a couple decades, it did help. And at the time, he was a minority assemblyman with no power and no clout and no ability to do anything. And all of a sudden, he had ingratiated a very, very large constituency. And I'm not talking about the several thousand people who lived in Curious Joel at the time. I'm talking about the 50,000 or so who lived in the Democratic stronghold of Brooklyn.
So just so we get all of this straight, these are not people who generally go off in different directions. They do what the head rabbi had to do.
They vote as a unit. As I said, 94% of them will vote in one direction because they never want it to be 100%. That's what they told me.
There's an anecdote in the book about one election cycle. The Los Angeles Times had sent reporters out to do exit polls randomly, and somehow in that random selection, Curious Joel came up. So you've got the LA Times reporter outside the school, which was a voting place, and the superintendent asked her what she's doing, and she said, well, I'm doing exit polls for the LA Times. And he just laughed in her face and said, you're going to screw up your whole poll, because I can tell you right now what the vote is. It's 5,000 to 4. We make four people vote the other way to prove that the machines were working.
That's pretty funny.
So now we get to the inherent corruption of Albany politics, because Curious Joel, like any Supreme Court case, is several different stories. At the local level, it was a fight between the parents and the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
At the state level, it was a political battle. At the national level, it was an ideological battle. But let me say at the state level, George Pataki was a Republican assemblyman who should have not been able to get a bill through, particularly when Mary McPhillips, who was the Democratic assemblyman from the district, voted against it.
And he couldn't get the bill through, which is why I needed Joe Lenthal.
So let's go back, because I think some people are probably holding their heads trying to figure out the whole lineage here, the whole story. We now have people who have created a village. They have created a school that will take care of their kids for them. But they have alienated an awful lot of, dare I say it, us, who really felt that this...
Not yet.
You're ahead of our story. We're about to get there.
Just to lay it out a little bit. So you've got this insular group that formed a village in Orange County. Everyone in the village is a member of the sect.
Right.
They've got a problem educating their children. They say, well, we're paying taxes. We're entitled to education at public expense. And the district says, you're right, send them over. That didn't work. So then you've got a problem of no one educating these children who are certainly entitled to it at government expense. And so how do you solve the problem? Pataki's brainstorm, really, was to allow the district, allow this village, allow the sect to form a school district. So all of a sudden, the sect has a school district.
So how does it get there? How does George Pataki pull this off? Mel Miller, who was speaker and fairly liberal in reform on constitutional issues, said, absolutely not. It will not happen in my house. So how did it pass his house 150-1?
Answer your own question.
The housing arrangements of assemblymen put George Pataki in the office on the same floor as a guy named Tony Genovese.
I remember him pretty well.
And George convinced Tony that in order to get the Satmar vote for Frank Macchiarola in a primary for comptroller in New York City.
Remember that too.
That they should put this bill through. And Joe Lenthal became the sponsor. It was the Lenthal-Pataki bill.
Now explain why Lenthal was so important.
Because he comes from the area of Brooklyn.
And he's a Democrat, and he could put legislation through in the assembly, and Pataki couldn't.
And he was a senior Democrat.
Senior Democrat from a very densely populated Hasidic area of Brooklyn. And so the bill whips through the assembly when no one believes it's going anywhere, the last week. And now we go to the Senate. And this is a great corruption story. How do we get a bill through the Senate that no one cares about and Billy Larkin is not in favor of?
And preferably no one knows about,
now,
including the people voting on it.
I'm sorry, John. Explain who Billy Larkin is, because that's an important piece of this.
Yeah.
You flip around words, but we're not sure who these guys are.
Forgive me. That's a fair point. State Senator Larkin, who has been the state senator from the Orange County area since, I believe, George Washington abandoned Newburgh.
That's true.
And has an incredible memory of everybody's stand on this issue except his, was very influential. But more influential was the fact that the then sitting senator was indicted, a guy named Skirmahorn, and a guy named Gray got the seat temporarily, having been at that moment the only Democrat to occupy that seat in like 100 and some years, before or since. And so the Senate has a special election coming up, and nobody wants to vote against this group. And so they package.
Nobody wants to vote against the Satmars because they vote as a bloc.
That's right. And so this bill gets packaged with 45 other bills at 5 o'clock in the morning on the last night of the legislative session.
When they got them tired and baying like sheep.
It's what I refer to as a vampire bill. It can never see the light of day. But no one cared. Mel Miller told me, and it's in the book, that none of us cared because we knew that Mario Cuomo was going to veto the bill on constitutional grounds.
Wrong.
Well, for them, it was a have-their-cake-and-eat-it situation, too. So the legislature could pass this bill, make them very popular with the Satmar community, and there's no danger it's going to really become law. Uh-oh.
So I go to see my former boss,
Mario,
and several days after, I made the assumption that he didn't know anything about this. This bill had whipped through out of nowhere at the end, and, you know, thousands of bills whipped through that way, or at least hundreds. And so I go to see a man I revered and said, there's this bill you need to know about. It's the most unconstitutional thing in decades. And Cuomo says to me, but Luigi, they don't ask for much.
So you knew the fix was in.
I knew at that moment it was over. So the conversation became very angry. And by the end of the—
Between you and he.
Yes.
And when he said they don't ask for much, clearly he knew that they were asking for a lot.
Now, he's right. And I didn't quite understand at the moment, but I do now. The teachers union, a very powerful group,
sure,
has 500 or 600 bills a year. And they know that they better prioritize them because they're not going to get all 500 or 600. They'll get maybe 10. And they trade on which ones they get. The Satmar don't do that. The Satmar go in for one or two things they want every year. And if you give it to us, you get 94% of our votes in both Brooklyn and Orange County. And if you don't, you lose them.
Mm-hmm.
Crystal clear, no ideological party affiliation.
Okay, jumping ahead, just for our audience's sake and for mine, there's a Brooklyn contingent of the Satmars. There's a Orange County contingent who were on board as one. Are they still on board as one?
Now, after the nephew died, his children don't get along very well.
With the Rebbe, you said? With the
there were two Rebbes now.
Yeah.
There are two Rebbes. One located in Kiryas Joel and the other's
and
located
so they're having,
in Brooklyn.
So they're fighting with each other.
But I have to give you the enormous admiration I have for their citizenry. They fight like cats and dogs, but not on election day.
Gotcha. Okay. So we still got one powerful voting bloc. Mario Cuomo, because I know a little bit of Mario, having had him on the radio for a million years, was that he was going to say, look, if you guys can't do the right thing, what do you think I'm going to be the veto guy who takes the hit on this, right?
I wish that were the case. I think he was involved a lot earlier and a lot.
You think he sold out?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you read his Forest Hills diary, you'll see that the Satmar endorsed him for lieutenant governor when he ran with Howard Samuels.
Yeah, sure. Howie the Horse.
Why? Since Mario Cuomo was the only public official who wouldn't let me interview him, I'll never know. But the story is deeper and longer than you think, and I don't know what it is.
Well, he knew why. He wasn't going to have you interview him because he didn't want to answer those questions.
Cuomo and I had a very close relationship and a frank one, and we both knew he was wrong.
Right. Well, there's wrong politically, and then there's wrong ethically. There's two different
stories. And sometimes both of those sides would emerge. You knew Cuomo better, much, much better than I did, certainly. But he was an intelligent, principled man. And I think in his heart, he thought what he was doing here was helping some handicapped kids who were sorely in need of help and who deserved help.
I don't think
in
so.
In his mind, I think he had to have known that this was unconstitutional. I think he had to have known that it was not a legitimate
solution.
Well,
he's a great constitutional lawyer, John Carr.
I know it. I know it. I think that's where he sold out. I think in his heart, I think he truly did want to help these kids.
Okay, now back to you, Lou Grummet, the co-author with John Carr, who we've just talked about, The Curious Case of Kiryas Joel, The Rise of a Village Theocracy and the Battle to Defend the Separation of Church and State. Now, you just said something which my ears right picked up. I said, I don't agree with you, John. That's your co-author. What did you mean?
I believe Mario Cuomo knew it was wrong, and let me explain why from the beginning. And he also knew that there were other ways to serve those kids constitutionally. I had been the assistant commissioner of the Education Department for disabled children. And in our angry discussion, I offered, there were only 13 children involved in the beginning from the village of Kiryas Joel. It's an interesting thing no one pays attention to, and that is that in the beginning, there were 60-some kids there, 13 who actually lived in the village, and most of the rest of them were from the East Ramapo School District. Kiryas Joel has served sort of the way a BOCES serves for East Ramapo, and no one seems to have figured that out, but Cuomo knew it. And I offered to get those kids free services and good educational programs one by one, all 13 of them. And Cuomo rejected that. And Cuomo,
so you think Cuomo had sold out to the Satmar for their political clout?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let me explain two things to you, Alan. One is that I worked for Cuomo for 3 years, and I sort of worshipped him. Those were the days when Mario Cuomo would say to me on a regular basis, as sincerely I thought as one possibly could, doing the right thing lasts longer, Luigi.
Yeah.
The answer to what John said is, yes, he knew the difference, but doing the right thing lasts longer. And the other thing is a story I'll tell you, that one day, and it's in the book, one day I was working for Secretary of State Cuomo, and he was being sent out to speak to the bishops on Long Island in defense of Governor Kerry's abortion policies. And he wished me farewell and told me he was going to be excommunicated 32 times. And I said to him, why are you doing this? And he said, because the Constitution is more important when you're a public official than my personal belief. So I was imbued with Mario Cuomo's belief that doing the right thing works. And when Mario Cuomo didn't do that, we ended our conversation by him saying, in any event, Luigi, who would sue? And I said, I would, Governor.
I am not sure, just because we're having this little discussion, Lou Grummet, that you're right about this. I think Mario Cuomo was one of the canniest politicians I have ever met. He used to talk to me about how, you know, the common politicians think one step in advance. I think, he says, six steps in advance. If I do this, he'll do that. Then after he does that, then I'll do this. I think he knew full well when he went out to Long Island to lecture the bishops that as a Catholic, as an Italian Catholic, he knew full well that he was going to get all kinds of credit from not only everybody who had a vowel in their name, after their name, but also from all the rest of the people who would respect his independence and his judgment.
I agree, Alan. I think Mario Cuomo and indeed Andrew Cuomo are very canny politicians. The difference was that I thought Mario had a moral base.
Oh, no, 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 no. I agree with you. I am not a big Andrew fan. I think he at least, Mario had the ability to talk the talk. And to do it well.
And the ability to rationalize things to fit into his moral code. I do think he had a strong moral code. I think in his mind there was a needy population here that he could help. And I think that he was able to rationalize what he was doing. And he was too smart a lawyer to not know that he was cutting corners
right.
in the Constitution.
But
and by the way, there's also some great political things here, six steps down the line, as you mentioned. So I think all that factored in. I think he was able to rationalize it. But I bet in his mind, if he were here today, he would say his sole concern was these handicapped kids. I'm sure he would say that.
He would say it.
And I think he would believe it.
But when Lou Grummet said just a little while ago that the Satmar were incredibly politically important, he knew that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you use the word rationalize, boy, are you right about that. Rationalize, anybody can say, I'm doing this thing, which many of us would think is despicable, but he would say, here's the reason why I'm doing it. And as I said, he could talk the talk and he could convince anybody of anything. I'll never forget the day he came on our Capital Connection show and decided he was going to lecture all of us and tell us why there was no mafia. And he could take that kind of an idea and present the most plausible explanation of it. And then the next day, of course, there was a headline in the Daily News. Yes, Mario, there is a mafia. But he could do that. So I like your word rationalize.
And by the way, Alan, in Judge Kaye's opinion, which I mentioned earlier, Judge Kaye points out the distinction that is the best pointing out, and we quote it extensively in the book. Judge Kaye pointed out that if you were going to help them, these people who don't ask for much,
yeah,
you would give them a narrow piece of legislation. Instead, the Pataki bill, which I think was inadvertent on Pataki's part, but Mario knew exactly what he was doing, gave them the fiscal power over millions and millions and millions of dollars having nothing to do with the handicapped children of the district.
Okay, so let's go on with this. This is very interesting. So now you have a school board, which is elected by regular citizens.
And the Grand Rebbe.
No. A school board which is elected by everybody.
You're talking about the Monroe-Woodbury School District?
Yeah, Monroe-Woodbury.
Okay, fair.
And you also have this village school board, and you have the Grand Rebbe calling the shots.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows that politically it's suicide to alienate this group of Satmar Jewish folks who have the ability to really either be 100% for you or not. And our political class has basically failed the test.
Except for one person. Interestingly, Mary McPhillips, who I barely know, so I'm not...
I know her, and she's wonderful.
And Mary McPhillips voted against this bill and then went on to get elected county exec.
Yeah. Well, because the county...
Thank you.
Think about this. If you spit in a glass of water, you got a glass of water with a lot of spit in it. But if you spit in the ocean, it ain't much. So she had, of course, a much bigger constituency when she ran for county.
Which is the real answer that makes this all so perplexing, because as powerful as the Satmar are and as wonderful a phone book as they have, in the overall count, there are not many votes.
Well, they are, depending on whether you're talking about the glass or the ocean.
That's correct. You've seen it,
Alan. That's exactly right.
That's where they're good at. They're good at the margins.
Well,
And Lou mentioned a figure at the beginning. The percentage of voting is, what, 94%?
Go to East Ramapo. I assume you've been covering the East Ramapo
situation. Oh, we have, in detail, in great detail, which is one of the reasons I want you guys here to talk about this case. All I know is I have a lot of friends, many of whom are Jewish, And they're furious about what happened over there, because there's the Satmar Jewish community, and then there's the sort of liberal social Jewish community, and boy, they are on two different sides on this.
But let me tell you an interesting thing, and I said this on every time we've been interviewed, so I want to say it to you. The real people who could solve East Ramapo are the people of East Ramapo.
The majority.
The ultra-Orthodox, it's not just Satmar, the ultra-Orthodox in East Ramapo turn out 90-some percent of their vote, and they have won all the seats on the East Ramapo School Board for 12 years now.
So that was the end of the East Ramapo School Board. A legendary woman who was the chairman of the school board.
Georgine Hyde, my hero.
Dismissed. Goodbye.
35 years, and she's gone.
Yeah.
Auschwitz survivor.
Wow.
Georgine was, by the way, not only Auschwitz, but Theresienstadt. She was in two camps.
Wow.
I knew Georgine well. We went to the Holocaust Museum together, one of the most incredible moments of my life. But having said that, the voter turnout, you can look, I don't know what today's voter turnout is for school boards in East Ramapo, but it's usually...
It's not 94%.
It's more like 9%, 10%, sure. 11%.
Very low.
Which means if the rest of East Ramapo would go to the polls, we wouldn't be having this problem.
But it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
And why?
It still doesn't.
And the question is, because usually, Lou and John, when there is a significant election turnout increases. If you get people who are running against each other, and we know that turnout increases. But what's happened now is, and this is the crux of the book to me, and what is so important is that the regular people, not the Satmar people, the others who send their kids to the schools, who have been downgraded, the support for education for everybody else from the Satmar community has been hardly good. And they're saving on the taxes for everybody. And then you get this low voter turnout. What does that tell you that the voters are thinking?
It tells you in East Ramapo, let's stay with East Ramapo.
Sure.
Because Kiryas Joel is a congruent community.
Sure.
East Ramapo is not. East Ramapo, as you pointed out, was a great school district, one of the best. What happened in East Ramapo is there are the two largest groups in East Ramapo of students, not citizens, but students. The largest group are in yeshivas, and their parents are sitting on the school board. And the second largest group are Latino. And the rest of the community, who is the overwhelming majority of East Ramapo, chooses not to go to vote to defend those kids. That's what's happening.
So tell us about why the Latino reference you just made is important.
Because they don't have a popular political support group. And it's their services that are being cut by the school board of East Ramapo and have been cut. Alan, this has been going on for 12 years. That means a kid who graduated last June has been deprived of his entire educational program. He may as well have been a black in Birmingham, Alabama in 1960 for all the support he's gotten from the citizens of New York.
Isn't there any anger?
Well, the State Education Department, as it is wont to do, comes in and does periodic examinations and studies, and they're all high-powered, and everybody praises them, and nothing happens. There are very specific things that could happen in East Ramapo to solve it, just like there were specific things in Kiryas Joel. If the State Education Department had gone in and told Monroe Woodbury, oh, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Serve those kids. If they had told the BOCES superintendent, Manny Axelrod, to serve the kids in a regional BOCES program like they would in most other parts of the state, there would never have been a school district in Kiryas Joel. I think the villain here is not the Satmar. They merely ask for the very things that they have the right to ask for. They just don't have the right to get.
Well, wait a second now, Lou. You're very, very gentle about this and very nice, but I do have some problems with the Satmar.
Maybe it's because I know them. I have problems with the people who were sworn to uphold the law of New York, the state of New York, and they don't do it.
No, I hear you, Lou. But at the same time, you set up a school that will handle your kids and your problem. Then you get people elected to the Board of Education, and they decide that they don't want to pay the taxes to support other people's children because they're sending their kids to the yeshivas. I happen to think that's despicable.
Well, I do too. And Alan, I told you under the fourth bill, the one that's...
Now, you have to go back and start talking to us about bills because you haven't introduced that yet.
Okay, forgive me. Let me back up.
So, well, let me explain this. I can do it real
ahead.
Quickly.
Yeah, great.
So when they had this problem, the legislature in the middle of the night passes a bill, and the bill basically said the village of Kiryas Joel gets a school district. That went through the courts. The courts shot it down, saying you can't set up a public school district for a religious sect. So then they went back and they made another bill. And they didn't mention Curious Joel. They just mentioned the criteria necessary to create a village school district. And guess what? Only one municipality in the history of the universe fit the criteria, Curious Joel. That got shot down. Then they came up with another one that was a little more general and which would, at least theoretically, I don't believe there are any communities that could fit the criteria, but at least it was theoretically possible that they could. And that got shot down. And then they broadened it a little bit more, and that's the one that got through. So what stands
on... What was in that one?
Some financial criteria, and so you could carve a district out of another district.
Meantime, the cowards in the legislature who knew this was wrong are all raising their hands because they don't want to tick off the Senate.
We agree. By the way, on the second and third and fourth bill, in my judgment, the first bill, I want to defend the legislature. I don't think anybody in the legislature except three or four people knew it was happening.
Too bad. That's their job.
I agree.
What's wrong with the New York legislative system.
It certainly is. Go ahead.
The second bill was outrageous. It was drafted by Cuomo's staff. Cuomo was furious about the Supreme Court decision. Remember, that was it. Go back. That was the time in 1994 when there was a vacancy in the Supreme Court, and a name being thrown around by everybody, especially Mario Cuomo's staff.
Was Mario Cuomo.
Whether that's true or not, we'll never know. But the fact...
I believe it wasn't true. And I believe he never was being considered. And I believe, because I happen to know a little about this, because I had many discussions with Mario about this, that what happened there was that there was a sort of agreement that the Clintons would consider him for this, bandying about his name, and that he would do what he actually did and write them a letter and say, I'm not interested. Now, Stephanopoulos has written a book in which he says it was all arranged. He was going to get the Supreme Court nomination. It never was. And Mario told me it never was.
Alan, from the same source, I agree with you. But let's go back to the period of time on our court case, because this is where I had my break with the Cuomo family, I think. What had been an intellectual debate stopped being one.
Yeah, yeah. And once you have that, goodbye.
It's goodbye. And what happened was that Mario Cuomo had gone to the village to campaign because by this time, ironically, he's running against George Pataki.
Can you imagine?
And he's in the village of Curious Joel, and he is speaking to 5,000 very excited women. And he says to them, if this bill, meaning the second bill, is declared unconstitutional, Shelley and I will pass a third one. And if this bill is declared unconstitutional, Shelley and I, by that time Shelley speaks, Shelley and I will pass a fourth one.
Just let's make sure that everybody knows that this is the same Shelley who is now on his way to the pokey.
Shelley Solar, who lived in the town of Monroe. And if this bill, the...
he lived in Monroe. He lived in Brooklyn, but he had a house.
He had a house, his mother's house in the town of Monroe. Yeah. Thank you. And if this bill, and he says it, and nobody pays any attention, and Cuomo thinks he's speaking to a group of people who don't speak much English anyhow, and it's fine, except there was some young kid in the audience who was taping it and who sent it to a place you may have heard of called 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a call from Ed Bradley, and Ed Bradley, who I don't know, of course, and Ed Bradley asked me if I would come down and let him interview me on the court case. So I said, sure. And Ed Bradley then, with the TV camera on me, shows me the tape of Mario Cuomo giving that speech.
And basically he said in that speech?
Quote, not basically, quote, if the second bill passed, he didn't say second bill, but he meant that. This bill is declared unconstitutional, we will pass, Shelley and I will pass a third one, and if that is declared unconstitutional, we will pass a fourth one, and if that is declared unconstitutional, we will pass a fifth one. So Ed Bradley shows me that tape.
Now he knows, let's get this straight, Cuomo knows he's up against Pataki, that Pataki has roots
into this group. In Pataki's home village, basically.
Has roots into this group. Help me out here, Lou and John. When the election was held for governor between Pataki and Cuomo...
It went to Cuomo.
It did?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay.
And Pataki wasn't surprised and didn't care. So he told me. But the issue here became important in my life because Ed Bradley shows me the tape. I am stunned. Visibly stunned, Bradley says to me, do you know Mr. Cuomo? I said, yeah, he was my mentor. I think he's brilliant. And he said, have you ever seen this tape before? And I said, oh, no. He said, what do you think of it? And I said, well, Ed, I grew up in the Upper South, and I remember a governor saying words just like that. And Bradley said, what words? And I said, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Now, that was taped in July or August of 1994. When do you think they showed it? The Sunday night before the Tuesday in November.
Right.
And there I was on the number one show in America at that time.
Did you get a telephone call from Mario?
Almost never got a call or any recognition again.
I had my share. And when he didn't like something you said, boy, he really let you have it. And that could be at 12 o'clock at night. I remember one time he called me up and he started yelling about some question I'd asked him on the show. And I mean, he was yelling. It took most of an hour. Finally, I said, Governor, can I say something? And he said, no, you've said enough. And he hung up the phone. So he had that capacity.
With that promise said to me, when he went to Curious Joe Allen and said, I will find a way to do this, he knew without a question what the Constitution was. The Supreme Court told him what the Constitution said. And what he was saying is, I will find a way to end run what the Supreme Court and the Constitution said.
And he did it.
One way or another, I will find a way to do it. And he did.
Actually, Pataki eventually
actually,
did.
Yes. By that time it was Pataki. But this doesn't coincide with the guy you described, and we all knew is a great constitutional scholar, looking for ways to end run the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, that's what great constitutional scholars do. They look for ways to get by the Supreme Court. So, Lou, back to you. Then what happened?
Well, so then, in short, to not bore your readers with the legalities of this, we beat the second case unanimously, I think, in the Court of Appeals.
The New York State Court of Appeals.
New York State Court of Appeals. They didn't even bother. It was such a poorly drafted bill, by the way, that Curious Joel's lawyers didn't defend it.
Mm-hmm.
They used a local Albany lawyer, whose name I forget.
And George Barber.
George Barber, who won once and then lost. And then Pataki put in the third bill, and we beat that in the Court of Appeals. And they tried to take that back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court wouldn't hear it. And then I left, and then the fourth bill happened. And hilariously, you know who the outside consultant on the fourth bill
was? Wait a second, because people aren't keeping up.
Sure.
You left your job at the New York State
School Boards Association. I was offered a job for reasons beyond my knowledge.
CPA.
To be the head of the CPA Society, a function. I love those people, but I knew nothing about what they did.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I left, and nobody challenged it. And it was challenged locally, but you know, in Orange County, but there wasn't a serious, well-done challenge. Well, one of the great stories, I think, Alan, that we tell in the book that is it cost, I don't know if you know this, but in order to take a Supreme Court case all the way,
sure,
just to have it argued in the Supreme Court, you have to spend at least $2-3 million.
Whoa. I had no idea.
For the attorneys. Read David Boies's books. He goes into that length. I didn't pay a dime. Jay Warona, who is still the counsel of the New York State School Board Association, is the real hero of this book. He took this case on as a volunteer, and you could say he was being paid at school boards, but he couldn't do it during the daytime because Monroe Woodbury, a member, threatened to bring a suit against the association. So Jay did it at night. Jay did this entire case for free.
And did he argue it standing up before the justices?
He sure did.
Okay.
I'll tell you a great story. We're there the night before, and Jay is, to say the least, nervous, particularly because he's up against Nat Lewin, who is an internationally known lawyer who's been in front of the Supreme Court many, many times on church-state issues. And my daughter is with me, and at the time, my daughter was a student at Yale Law School. And there were no Google at that time, let's remember this. And so Jay says, he's been in front of the Supreme Court 27 times. I've never even been in the building but once. And my daughter, the Yale law student, says, don't worry about Jay. He lost 23 of those. And Jay relaxed dramatically. And we get up to the room, and I said, how did you know that? And she said, I didn't.
That's very funny. That's very funny. Okay, so now the Supreme Court does what?
Supreme Court goes 6-3 with us, Justice Souter, in a decision nobody expected Souter to do.
Yep.
Everyone thought it would come from Blackmun or from Stevens, particularly. Yep. And it was a very interesting case because it was Ginsburg's first case that she sat on, and Ginsburg, you know— everyone knew where she stood on church state issues.
She's from Brooklyn, and she's Jewish.
No one knew where she stood on Jewish issues. And so they thought they won. They went back, and they had a party. They thought they won. But we discovered by reading Justice Blackmun's notes, and it's in the book, that 48 hours after the case, we had won 6-3. And Scalia turned on Souter. And if you haven't done this, I recommend that all your listeners, and you read, if you read nothing else, we'll read the book. But if you read nothing else besides that, read Scalia's dissent from start to finish. It is probably the most outrageous dissent because he was so angry at Souter. And then reread Souter's opinion because he took Scalia apart in the opinion in ways you didn't notice until you got to Scalia's dissent.
Let me just point out, because you just did it, the name of this book, if our listeners want to read it, it's The Curious Case of Curious Joel. The Rise of a Village Theocracy and the Battle to Defend the Separation of Church and State. Let me very quickly, Lou Grummet and John Carr, ask you about the word theocracy here. Basically, what you're saying is there was a putsch. The group, the Satmars, took over the government. They elected their people. They voted as a unit. And they did what you both think was clearly unconstitutional. But here's the important part. They got away with it. They got away with it. They're still there. People are still furious at what they were able to do. They lowered the support for general education in the town, and they ended up screwing all these people of Spanish descent, African-Americans, others, and nobody gave a damn.
Alan, if you paid any attention, and I'm sure you did, to the Hobby Lobby case,
yep,
that court would not have gone our way in Curious Joel. In Hobby Lobby, using exactly the thought you just gave, they declared that a corporation could have religious principles, an insane position, and once the corporation made clear what its principles were, they could enforce those principles on their employees. Stated that way is about as unconstitutional a decision as you could possibly have, and it came from the Supreme Court of the United States because, as you just said, no one cares. The balance, which John is more articulate than I am, on the balance between Jefferson and Madison. Jefferson believing in total separation of church and state, and Madison believing in equality, you know, amongst different religions. Sure. The Supreme Court, and the way they constructed the First Amendment, was a balance. You have both freedom to worship and freedom from worship. And the Supreme Court lately, and the Satmar, believe that freedom to worship is the only thing that counts in the Constitution, and freedom from religion has been buried, and I would argue that those of us on the liberal side have been too quiet for too long.
So Scalia dies, and now we have a 4-4 Supreme Court. We have a presidential election going between, you know, probably Hillary Clinton and probably somebody like either Ted Cruz or Donald Trump or somebody like that. The future of the country, in my opinion, rests on who's sitting on that court.
We agree.
Absolutely.
Who's sitting on that court. And this is a very instructive story that you're telling me because—
That's why we wanted to write it now.
Because Lou and John, you tell a story in which had Scalia not been there and had other voices been there, the other side, you know, eventually with all of this developing would have won. Instead, it went the other way.
You know, one of the things that I think is somewhat lost here and needs to be said, I'm sure the leaders of Curious Joel would not admit this now, but when push comes to shove, Lou did them an enormous favor, and I'll tell you why. Because the First Amendment is the instrument that protects their way of life, their ancient traditions, their principles, their way of worship. And by attacking that, I really think they're undermining the very instrument of their existence. Lou made sure that it stands strong. If Lou had lost that, there would have been a very important protection that would be missing.
Let me put it as clearly as I can. If you can use public funding to build a ghetto wall because the people inside want the wall, then you can use public funding to build that same ghetto wall because the people outside want that same wall.
Well, in fact, in the Southern cases, desegregation, we know that that was exactly the issue. They were going to set up private schools and do all of that stuff, and they were told no.
That's right.
One of the interesting things that I picked up on early, I stumbled on this case. I guess I was probably the first reporter to stumble on it as a reporter for the Times Union and followed it throughout its history. But one of the things that struck me very quickly was how this had divided the Jewish community, and that all the mainstream Jewish communities or Jewish groups were on Lou's side, following Amici on his side. They were not supporting what was going on in Curious Joel. And at first it seemed peculiar to me, but as I read their briefs and thought about it, it made perfect sense.
All Jews are not the same.
And who in the world knows better than a Jew the dangers of church-state entanglement?
Sure.
Alan, I grew up in West Virginia. I was one of two Jewish kids in West Virginia. We were both in the Honor Society, so we filled all the stereotypes. But I know what it's like to be a tiny minority in a big area that doesn't care. And to me, this is one of the most important issues in front of America, and I'm appalled that the country doesn't seem to care right now.
Now, I take it that you guys have done extensive interviewing for this book, and you have some sense. John used the word earlier in the interview, which I thought was really great, which is the ability to rationalize. In their own minds, I always like to ask politicians this question. I put a lie detector on your arm. And flat line means you're telling the truth. Wavy line means you're lying. You say to them, to the Satmar people, come on now, this is the whole thing. There are other kids involved. Is this right? And they look you in the eye and they say...
That's not the right question, they will tell you.
But it's the question. I see.
What they will tell you is, the question is, we only want to be left to live the way our grandparents did in Hungary.
But screw the other people who have to live up here.
We don't harm them. We don't have anything to do with them.
We're taking their money away from running their school board.
I'm telling you what their answers are, because I had this debate with them for 10 years.
Ah, but we're paying a fortune in school taxes, and we don't have any kids in this school.
That's right. And you could come to Albany, New York, and you could talk to somebody who sent their kid to Catholic school. You could ask the same question.
Of course.
And they would say, you know, I don't like it, but I pay my taxes. I don't try to take over the government.
Forget religion for a minute. This is a church-state issue. But let me go to a broader question you're now asking. Under the fourth law, the one that passed, why couldn't one of many of the retirement communities that exist in the Hudson Valley and around Binghamton, where they don't allow kids?
Right.
Why couldn't they secede from their school district so they won't have to pay any taxes?
You mean set up their own school district?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And then set up a school district. And guess what? We don't have any taxes because we don't have any kids.
We worry. One of the reasons...
That is somewhat the legacy of this fourth.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because I talk to those groups sometimes. They invite me to speak. And inevitably, this kind of subject comes up. And there is such a pro-education for everybody sentiment in those retirement groups that it would never happen.
Oh, forget the retirement groups. Yeah. Think of other groups.
You raised the retirement.
No, we did, but I don't forget. Let me interrupt here, because education's my bag.
Yes, indeed.
You go to people our age who grew up in a time when most families had kids in schools.
Right.
Today, 75-80% of New Yorkers do not have kids or grandkids in school. And Alan, if you went to the retirement communities in 20 years, you'll get a different answer.
That's very cynical. I hope not.
I hope not, too. What we've got in the books now and has not been attempted yet is a law. Remember, to back up, the first law allowed only Curious Joel to do this. The latest law, or the law that survives, allows anybody to do
it. Interesting. Has there been any, John Carr, has there been any follow-up on that? In other words, have you seen anybody else try it besides the Satmars and Curious Joel?
Not yet.
The assemblyman in East Ramapo called me and said, would you go to court in your retirement if East Ramapo formed a school district? And I said, assemblyman, you're missing the whole point. Curious Joel, as bad as it was a contiguous group of 600 and some, you know, people called a village. East Ramapo, they're all over the place. What are you going to do? Put blood X's, this being Passover season? You're going to put X's on the Jews' doors? I mean, how are you going to decide who in East Ramapo belongs to that school district?
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to ask you guys this. This is a very important case, as we know. Your book is a very important book because it sort of, and I think very fairly describes, you know, what was going on. You are not vitriolic. You try to understand what the other guys had to say and why they said it and all the rest of it. But everybody I talk to is furious about this outcome. But that sometimes bad outcomes happen in politics, don't they?
Yes, and I think what people are furious about right now is what's going on in East Ramapo, where you've got a group of people with no kids in the school. Most of them probably don't have a high school education, running the schools, closing down the schools, and that sort of thing. But as Lou mentioned a while ago, there's a very, very simple remedy to that. Vote.
Yeah, well,
they can stop at any time they want.
It's, I mean,
so what you're saying,
the same way the sect took over the school board, anyone else can. Any other group can.
Yeah, yeah.
They can outvote them easily.
So what you're saying is we get what we deserve, but I don't believe that. I don't believe we get what we deserve. I believe people are lazy. That's right. I don't believe they show up at the polls when they should. Nevertheless, this is a disgrace, this outcome.
Yes, but one of the reasons, I totally agree with you, obviously.
Yeah.
But the reason you and I differed on one point is I have more sympathy for the Satmars because what they did is used the American system, and the people who have lost are the people who don't use it. They choose to not use it.
Okay, you made that point several times, Lou, and I hear you. It is better to vote. We get the outcomes because we don't vote. There was a recent election on Long Island in which a Democrat, Todd Kaminsky, was running against a guy by the name of McGrath. He won by 600 votes. I guarantee you there are a lot of people waking up the next day saying, I should have voted. and that that kind of thing happens in politics.
Especially when I discovered that Mel Brooks was his uncle.
His uncle. And you will remember, I've said it too many times, that the most famous thing that Mel Brooks said as the 2,000-year-old man was, I have all these kids, all these wives, all these children, and not one postcard saying, how are you, Pop? And the fact of the matter is that Kaminsky, the former prosecutor, who was obviously a very formidable candidate, won, but probably because Mel Brooks made the robocalls. So anyway, what bothers me, and I'm sure bothers everybody who's listening to this and bothers you guys who bothered to write a book about this, is that a bad outcome came out of this.
Do I have time for one more story?
Yeah, sure.
You're a professor. I was asked on one of the other interview shows, which is why I want to tell you the story again, because it's your story. Have we learned anything? Mm. So let me say, why not? You remember the year that the current Governor Cuomo cut tap?
Yep.
Was a 20% cut, if I remember correctly?
I don't.
It was big. Whatever it was big. At the same time they were cutting tap overall, they were adding $18 million, give or take, in new money for the United Talmudic Academy for tap. A thoroughly unconstitutional use of that money, which happened and no one sued.
That's right. So it takes a Lou Grummet. In your position as the head of the New York State School Boards Association, despite the fact that the district that you were going to sue was in it, in the association, and yet I'm surprised they didn't sue you to say that you couldn't do that.
They threatened to file a waste suit, and that's when Jay went volunteer.
I see. I get it.
Because they couldn't find any money we were spending.
Well, Lou Grummet, I want to thank you. John Carr, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
This is an incredibly important book. The name of the book is The Curious Case of Kiryas Joel, The Rise of a Village Theocracy, and the Battle to Defend the Separation of Church and State by Lou Grummet and John Carr. And in the introduction is written by the very woman you talked to, the late Judith Kay. Thank you for being here, gentlemen.
Thank you, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.